This is Diane Horn, your host on the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and online at kexp.org. My guest this morning is Marjorie Kelly. Marjorie is a fellow at TELUS Institute and director of ownership strategy with Cutting Edge Capital. She is author of The Divine Right of Capital and co-founded Business Ethics Magazine and Corporation 2020. Marjorie Kelly is here today to tell us about her book, Owning Our Future, The Emerging Ownership Revolution, published in 2012. Welcome, Marjorie.
Thanks for having me, Diane.
What led you to write your book, Owning Our Future? What is your purpose?
You know, I've been tracking corporate social responsibility and social investing for about 25 years and asked myself, why isn't this stuff catching on? You know, why aren't more businesses being responsible? And I've come to see that ownership is really the original system condition, as one person put it. It's what keeps our economy locked into the behaviors that we have. And yet I'm seeing a new kind of ownership emerging that really show forth a really different kind of economy. So I wanted to write the book to go on a journey and see what's going on in this new kind of economy.
In your book, you speak about extractive and generative ownership models. First, what is extractive ownership?
Yeah, we live with a single dominant kind of ownership, and it's Wall Street-controlled ownership. So it's the publicly traded company where ownership shares trade on Wall Street. But in general, extractive ownership is about extracting maximum financial gains, particularly in the short run. So that's what it's about. It's about extracting finance.
How has the extractive ownership model affected our society?
You know, it's an interesting question because I think, you know, when you look back at its beginnings in the early 1900s, late 1800s, it really helped the growth of the economy. It helped us have the modern world. I mean, I don't think we would have automobiles and everything that is the major dominant economy if we didn't have this form of financing companies and growing the economy. But we're in a different world than we were when the Industrial Revolution began. We're in a world of limits. We're in a world of too much. And so I think what we're starting to see now is what I call excess extraction. You know, when there isn't enough profit to go around, companies will become more extractive. And we saw this, for example, in the wake of the initial downturn in 2008 and 2009, when companies, they kept their profits up really at record levels, and they did it by laying off employees or cutting benefits or going to part-time work. We've also seen companies systematically evade taxes. So you can start out being clever and good at making a profit, and at the extreme, it can end up extracting from employees and the communities and the environment.
How does the current extractive ownership design help drive growth?
You know, that's a really great question because a lot of people, when they talk about growth, they'll focus on consumerism, or they'll talk about how politicians want GDP to grow, and those things are all true. But there's also another level where growth is locked in, and I think that's in extractive ownership design, where you have earnings, also called profits, have to grow quarter by quarter in order to keep stock price up. And when they falter even a little bit, they don't even have to fall. They can just not grow quite as rapidly, and then you see stock price collapse. There was an instance not too long ago with Green Mountain Coffee. They had rapid growth because they were selling these little cups for making coffee. And when their growth slowed down just a little bit, their stock price fell 47% in a single day. So there's this tremendous pressure to keep earnings and profits growing, and that keeps the whole thing locked in.
Now, what is generative ownership and how is it different from extractive ownership?
Yeah, this is really, I think, what I'm seeing and have been seeing and I'm trying to describe in the book. I mean, I name it because, you know, while extractive ownership is one thing, it's publicly traded companies, Wall Street ownership, generative ownership is a lot of things. There's biodiversity there. It includes cooperatives and employee-owned companies and maybe municipal companies when a little city or town owns its own electric plant. It includes emerging social enterprises that have a really deep social mission, like maybe they're trying to hire the unemployed or something like that. So there's a variety of ownership designs in there, and what makes them a unified family of design is they have a purpose of creating the conditions for life. I mean, these are banks that want to make loans to help people stay in their homes, not to extract as much money as possible. Or, you know, it might be food companies that want to create a new kind of food economy and not just sell for the highest possible price. So there's a surprising number of these companies, and I unite them together just with language and say, this is really a generative economy. This is a different kind of economy, and it's already here in seed form.
Would you give a brief overview of the core elements of generative design that you talk about in your book?
Yeah. I mean, I start with the recognition that ownership is really the social architecture that holds things in place. I mean, you know, social architecture, we have the court system, we have Congress. These are social architectures that hold certain values in place. And we have, you know, like in democracy, it's equality and liberty and justice. And those are the values that are supposed to be designed into the social architecture of democracy. So what's the social architecture in economy if we wanted to hold in place values like a community and sustainability and fairness? So I look and I travel around and I see, okay, well, first of all, it's purpose. I mean, you have to have a living purpose. This is what economies have been about for more than 10,000 years. I mean, we grow food, we make houses, we make clothing. These are living purposes. This is what economies are about. And we've wandered off into these financial purposes. So living purpose is critical. And then you have what we traditionally call ownership. I call it membership. Who is a member of the enterprise? With a cooperative, for example, you can have employee-owned cooperatives. You can have stockholder-owned companies. You can have customer-owned companies, like a credit union. If you bank at a credit union, then you are one of the owners, one of the members of the credit union. So when you draw a circle and say who's inside this circle, it gets to make decisions and have their purposes served. Those are the members. So that's the second. So purpose, membership, and then you have governance. How do you keep purposes in place, and how do you allow people to have a voice? That's governance. That's the board of directors, and it's other things too, like annual reporting and so forth. So governance, and then you have capitalization. How do you get capital into these entities without having capital run off with all the power and control the purpose? So you have stakeholder finance. There's a lot of models of how you get your stakeholders to finance your enterprise and do so with similar values as the founders have. So that's capitalization. And then finally, the fifth is networks. And no enterprise is an island unto itself. You have networks that help hold in place certain values. For example, the Global Network of Cooperatives has the Rochdale Principles, which is an articulation of ethical principles over 100 years old. And that helps define what cooperatives are and helps keep this whole network on course. So those are the elements.
I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Marjorie Kelly, author of the book Owning Our Future, The Emerging Ownership Revolution. And you are tuned to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. Would you give us some specific examples of generative ownership, particular companies or organizations?
Sure, I'll give you a couple. One of the biggest and most interesting that I visit in the book, it's called the John Lewis Partnership. It's the largest department store chain in the United Kingdom, and there's a chain of 200 grocery stores that are part of it. It's a quite large company. It's about $5 billion in revenue. And it's completely owned by its employees and has a declared purpose of serving employee happiness, which is really wonderful. And they have a bicameral governance design. Employees directly elect a partnership council, and then that council in turn appoints about a third of the board of directors. So this is a company that in all its governing, ownership, purpose, it's all directed toward employee happiness. And, of course, they also serve customers, as any company does. So it's been a remarkable success story. It's over 100 years old and very little known, and I think deserves to be more widely known. So that's a great one. Another one I go visit is called Minwind. It's in southern Minnesota. It's a series of wind farms standing on agricultural farms. It's a farmer-owned company, and the farmers own these turbines in connection with local investors. And so when they wanted to raise the money for this, they went out and sold shares locally. You had to be a state resident in order to invest. They wanted people to be mostly local. They said nobody can own more than 15%. So the whole goal is to keep wealth local with these wind farms. And they raised millions of dollars in like a matter of weeks when they were putting these up. So it's an example of, you know, there's that stakeholder finance I was talking about. And the purpose is to save the family farm and help these farmers become more productive. And the purpose is also to generate renewable energy. So it's a lovely model in a lot of different ways. So there are others. I also visit Novo Nordisk, which is a very interesting pharmaceutical company in Denmark. It's in the multiple billions in terms of revenue. And it's a foundation-controlled company. I call it the mission-controlled company. It's a category that I had to name because I haven't seen anybody name it before. But foundation-controlled companies are common throughout Northern Europe. IKEA is one, Bertelsmann is one, which is a big media company, and Novo Nordisk. And their purpose is to defeat diabetes. And so the foundation has ordinary people sitting on its board. Like, I think there are scientists there, there are community members and so forth. And each year, the CEO of this multi-billion dollar company needs to go to the foundation board and say, you know, here's how we carried out our social mission and our ecological mission, as well as how we met our financial targets. So they have wonderful reporting. They're very serious about their corporate social responsibility. And yet, they also have full liquidity, which means investors, you and I could go invest in Novo Nordisk tomorrow. It trades on the normal stock exchange and can get in and out of shares quickly. And yet, its mission is held in place because of super voting shares held by the foundation. So investors can come and go, but the mission is not for sale. It's held by what I call mission shares, those super voting shares, which keeps it on target.
How widespread is generative ownership at present?
You know, it's much bigger than people realize. For example, banks alone, cooperative banks. Now, these are banks that are owned by the people who bank there and democratically governed by them, and their purpose is to serve these people. Cooperative banks are found all over the world, and 20% of deposits across Europe are in cooperative banks. Rabobank, which is in the Netherlands, holds about 43% of deposits in that country. But cooperative banks remain all too invisible, I find. Other examples, credit unions. There are thousands of credit unions. Cooperatives in general employ more people than all multinationals combined. So it's a much larger phenomenon that people realize. For example, in Kenya, cooperatives represent 45% of GDP. And in New Zealand, it's 22% of GDP. So cooperatives are a much bigger phenomenon than people realize. Employee ownership, there are 11,000 employee-owned firms, and about 3,000 of them are majority-owned by employees. So that's also a large phenomenon. So in general, it's a much bigger family of companies than people realize.
And why is it that we don't realize that these companies exist? Why isn't it more prevalent in our thinking?
That's a very intriguing inquiry. And I think that the reason is that we've been so focused on the stock market for so long that we have come to think of companies owned by the stock market as representing the entire economy. I mean, look at the John Lewis Partnership. Who's ever heard of it? It's larger than Monsanto. But no one's heard of it because you can't invest in it. And so you don't have analysts tracking it. You don't have the financial news reporting on it every night. If you think about it, most of our business news is through the lens of finance. I mean, we have the Wall Street Journal. That's the newspaper of record for finance. Or you have the Financial Times in London. And so, you know, in the same way that we have a world where history has been viewed through the lens of men or through the lens of white people, we have an economy that's viewed through the lens of finance. And so we have this, I call it capital bias. I mean, you can also call it capitalism. You know, it's an economy that's designed to benefit finance, is controlled by finance, and you measure success by return to finance. I mean, that's the ism that we live with. And so what's outside that frame is just literally invisible, in the same way that women and Indians and blacks remained invisible for a long time.
Would you speak about your earlier thinking about trying to change publicly traded corporations and what you see as the inherent problems with this approach?
You know, I think that's a kind of a primitive first cut approach. I'm the co-founder of an initiative called Corporation 2020. And starting in around 2005, we at TELUS Institute gathered people together. There were hundreds of people involved in this, from finance, labor, law, civil society, and so forth, business, investing. And we brought these people together for regular meetings and talked about how would you design corporations differently? If control by finance is the problem, how would you do it differently? And one of the people in our group was a woman called Deborah Doan, and she was from London, and she led a coalition of activist groups. I think there were more than 100 activist groups that were part of this, and they drove an initiative to redefine fiduciary duty in British law. Fiduciary duty says, you know, you have to serve stockholders above all. And they said, okay, if that's the problem, let's go right to the source and let's change the law. And they worked on this for years, and they finally got something through Parliament. But by the time they did, it was so watered down. What it said is that boards of directors have a duty to serve a variety of stakeholders to the extent that it benefits shareholders. You know, and so after all this work, 100 groups, years of effort, they could not pierce through this worldview, this paradigm that sort of says, no, corporations exist to serve their shareholders. It's so deep. It's because they're the owners and blah, blah, blah. It goes all the way back to the Magna Carta when property owners said, no, we own our property and the king doesn't. You know, so property ownership is a really deep, deep meme in our society. And so what I realized when I saw this happen is it's like trying to drive a new piece of DNA into a gorilla. You can't change a gorilla and turn it into a swan by just changing its DNA. I mean, you have to think over a long term. You have to think of large systemic change. I mean, I think the problem of ownership design is as big as global warming. I think it's just as important. I think it's more hidden, but it's just as important. And so you have to think long term. For example, we need to promote employee ownership. I mean, there are lots of baby boom companies right now that need to be sold. Then they're not going to pass them on to their offspring. Surveys have shown this. And so they might sell them to the employees if the right incentives were in place. And, you know, so that's one thing. We can promote the growth of cooperatives. We can promote the growth of stakeholder finance, or it's also called impact investing. So I think, you know, we can build a new economy on the foundation of ownership. And, you know, as crisis comes along, we can also begin to shift some of the big companies. Like, you know, for example, back with the 2008 crisis, the U.S. government held many of the largest banks in its hands. We, the people, had control over these large financial institutions. We could have said, you must recharter as a generative company. You will have public interest directors on your board. You will limit CEO pay, so forth. We could have done anything. But it's not part of the public discourse yet. We don't have a nuanced, sophisticated policy option that says this is how companies ought to be designed. And anytime the government's in control, you know, we will recharter them. So there's a whole kind of thinking that we're just beginning. And that's what I'm trying to kind of help move along a bit with my book.
You are listening to the sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters on KEXP Seattle 90.3 FM and on the web at kexp.org. I'm Diane Horn, and my guest is Marjorie Kelly, author of the book, Owning Our Future, The Emerging Ownership Revolution. How well do you think generative ownership companies can deal with the need of our society to curb growth?
I think that's a really key question, and I think that it's going to take a lot. I mean, for example, just because you create employee ownership doesn't mean you've solved the problem of growth. I really don't think that you have. So I think we need ecological approaches. At the same time, do we need, you know, sort of social design, social architecture approaches? But I'll say this, that I think what you do with generative design is you remove that kind of white-knuckle need to grow earnings quarter after quarter into infinity. I mean, if you have a partnership, if you have an employee-owned firm, if you have a municipally-owned company, that company can hit a nice high level of revenue and just stay there. And essentially flatline. You can have the steady state economy that Herman Daly talks about if you have its ownership in the hands of the community or the employees or our customers. They don't have a need for revenue to grow quarter after quarter, but the stock market does. And so I think you remove that need for growth. Now, there's also habit. There's a desire for employees to have raises. There's a desire to have more market share. There are other kinds of incentives in business to continue growing. So I think you also need a cultural shift. You need a mind shift in business schools, I think, as well as in consumers and employees, you know, to recognize that more is not always better. We need enough. So you don't solve it all with the tinkerings of social architecture. There's a value shift that I think has to happen, too.
Looking at the current companies that have generative design, how well are they dealing with environmental issues, such as trying to help address climate change?
Some are and some aren't. I think that you have some companies excel at something like employee ownership. Some excel at ecological stewardship. And it's hard to find companies that are great across the board. There are some. John Lewis Partnership is doing pretty well at managing its ecological footprint. They're shifting to different kinds of trucks that are more environmental friendly. They're looking at shipping issues and things like this. They're taking some steps. You know, they're not 100% there. There are some examples of generative design that are great for the environment. One of the most interesting is the community forests of Mexico. And these are forests that are owned by local communities. And often these are indigenous peoples. They're controlled by them. And so when you have forests that indigenous people are living off of, they're making furniture, they're doing some sustainable harvesting, they have an incentive to stop poaching and to stop deforestation. And it's been shown that this actually happens. And so community forests of Mexico and actually all over the world have been shown to be a way to stop deforestation, which is a source of about 20% of carbon emissions. And so that's an example of a large-scale example where locally rooted ownership and governance can really change the game ecologically. Another example I would point to is the Maine lobster industry, where there's a framework in place in state law that, among other things, says only owner-occupied boats can fish for lobsters in the sensitive inshore waters where the lobster breed. And what that means is you have people who understand local customs. These are small boats. They basically pass from a parent to child. And the big corporate boats that come in and just trawl the bottom and stir everything up and take all the lobsters literally cannot function there. They can only get licenses offshore. And this has been shown to really protect the lobster in the whole Gulf of Maine. It's the only fishery in the entire Gulf of Maine that is not overfished. And part of the reason is these ownership rules that are in place.
To what extent do the successful companies with a generative model serve as a template for other companies that aspire to be generative?
Oh, you know, I think that there are templates out there. There's not a one-size-fits-all template. I think that's what's different about generative design as opposed to extractive. I mean, extractive design, everybody wants to go public. Everybody wants to have their earnings grow rapidly, rapid growth. I mean, it's just one model. Whereas generative design is a bit more nuanced. In the banking sector, you might have a credit union, or you might have a cooperative bank, which is slightly different, or you might have just a locally owned bank. There's a state-owned bank in North Dakota, which is starting to be a template. So I think what you see is you see examples emerge that are locally rooted and that make sense in a particular geography or particular community, and then they can be replicated in other similar communities. So I think there are templates out there, but there's a lot more of them. There's not a single one.
You alluded to this a bit earlier, but what steps can we take to move towards more generative ownership?
Well, I think the first thing that we can do is see that it exists, and that it exists as a unified phenomenon. Because right now, it seems like corporations, you know, publicly traded multinational corporations, are the entire economy. And then we think, oh, there's a few little, you know, weird things off there to the side. But I think to see that, no, there's really an extractive economy and there's a generative economy. We already know how to organize a different kind of economy. It's a bigger phenomenon than we realize. So drawing a circle around cooperatives, employee ownership, municipal ownership, social enterprise, and saying this is really all a single phenomenon, I think that is tremendously powerful. So I think that's really a first step. I think we cannot underestimate how important seeing and language is. So talking about the generative economy, I think, is key. And then I think we need to begin thinking sector by sector. And I think we need to be thinking both what is growing up from the grassroots, because that is where this is emerging right now, and then long-term, what are the policy initiatives that could begin to take these things to scale? So you have a phenomenon that is called emergence. And so you have people, for example, right now completely reinventing the food economy. We have farmers markets springing up and community-supported agriculture. And these are just spontaneous community movements to say we need a different kind of food economy. And then a second stage is what are the kind of policy initiatives and supportive frameworks in financing and so forth that can take these things to scale. I think that's kind of the way to look at it. It's important to reform the existing economy, the extractive economy, and I wouldn't discourage anyone if they feel like that's their mission or that's what they see they need to work on. That's important. But beside that, we're also growing the generative economy and working out the nuances of how it can hold together and go to scale. I think that both of those initiatives are important.
Well, what's the message you'd like to leave our listeners with?
I think the message I would like to leave us with is that there is hope, that while something is falling apart, it's not the whole world. It's a particular way of organizing the world, organizing the economy, and it has to fall apart if we're going to move systematically to something else. So I think that we can read in the signs of disruption that we're feeling the signal that I think a harmful way, too extractive kind of economy is starting to break down. But the new generative economy is growing right alongside it, and I'm just tremendously hopeful that we are going to succeed in building a new kind of economy.
Well, thanks so much for being here, Marjorie.
Well, thanks for having me, Diane. This is fun.
You have just been listening to Marjorie Kelly, author of the book Owning Our Future, The Emerging Ownership Revolution, published in 2012 by Barrett Kohler Publishers. For more information, check on the web at owningourfuture.com. Again, that's owningourfuture.com. The sustainability segment of Mind Over Matters program you have just heard will be on the streaming archive section of KEXP's website at kexp.org for the next 14 days. In addition, sustainability segment interviews are available as podcasts, along with KEXP's music podcasts. Go to kexp.org, click on Demand, and then Podcasting. I'm Diane Horn. Thanks for listening, and be sure to tune in to the sustainability segment again next week on 90.3 FM and KEXP.org.